Hello, and welcome to The Assembly Line, Dev Bytes. I'm your host, Kevin from Kahan Games, and I'm here to talk about homebrew. So, the previous couple interviews I've done have been with straight-up developers, programmers, and this time I wanted to switch it up a little bit. I mean, a lot goes into making these games. It's not just programmers. We have musicians, we have artists, you know, not to mention beta testers and all sorts of people that come together to make these games what they are. And everyone needs to have their story told. And I'm really excited today to talk to Sergio Elizondo. If you don't know who Sergio is, he is a legend. I mean, he's been around the scene. I feel like he joined Nintendo Age back in, I don't know, 07, 08. Seems like it was so long ago. So I've known of Sergio a while. I had the pleasure of meeting him, I think for the first time in Portland, although it might have been at MAGFest. I got to see him perform with Sergio and the Holograms, which is a fantastic live show. If you guys ever have the opportunity to check him out, he is a super talented musician, and he can play everything. I mean, if you look up any of his videos on YouTube, he's playing all the instruments. Not only can he play, he can record. So he knows the ins and outs of music, performing, recording, just the whole industry. He does lessons. So yeah, I'm super excited to talk to him. So strap yourself in and learn about the man, the myth, the legend, Sergio Elizondo. All right, so I'm here with Sergio Elizondo. He's actually the first musician I've had on the podcast. You might know him from a number of things. Sergio and the Holograms, of course. He had the Kickstarter for the A Winner Is You, the first NES cartridge with real music on it. And you also might know him from some of his homebrew projects like Ninja 1 and 2. How you doing, Sergio?
Hey, good, man. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, for sure, man. You know, you and I have been friends for a long time, it seems like, a number
of years.
It's
been a while.
Yeah. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast and sort of talk through your process.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Totally. It's a pleasure of mine. Thanks for having me, too. Again, it's I look forward to sharing, you know, some of my secrets and some of the things that I've done. And yeah.
Hell yeah. So let's kind of go back to the beginning when you were a kid. Like, can you think of the earliest video game related memory you have?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the earliest memory that I have was peering into my parents, like at the house that I grew up in, looking into the garage and seeing my oldest brother. They had just bought an NES, my mom and dad did. And he was playing it. He was playing Mario Brothers on there. And I had no idea what it was. I've never seen like a video game console before. I'd only heard roughly about it. I think at the time I was like 4 or 5.
Wow.
And yeah, so they had just gotten a console. And yeah, so I was like, okay, that looks kind of cool. You know, what's he holding? Like, what is that? Like, that's kind of neat, you know? And shortly after, I feel like it was a bit of a blur. Within weeks, I was already on it. Like, I was playing Mario Brothers for the first time and Duck Hunt. And it was just, it was such a weird, like, I don't know. I feel like kind of like this dreamlike introduction to gaming in general. And little did I know at the time that this was something that would stick with me, you know, for the rest of my life. I mean, yeah. I'm doing it now, and I'm still playing games, developing games, working on games, writing music for games, whatever it is, but it's always game related. And just to see the evolution of that, from those, like, you know, first, just that vivid memory, you know, it's this kind of dreamlike, to be honest, but it's really cool to see it change the way it has over the years.
Man, it's awesome that the NES was your first system. I grew up, I think I was at my grandma's house in Ohio, and there were some neighborhood kids, and the kid next door, his name was Michael, I think. I think he got in trouble, so he wound up like bringing his entire Atari 2600 system and collection over to my grandma's house and just kind of like handed it to us and said, "My mom says you should have this."
Wow.
So Yeah, I grew up playing Atari and Intellivision, but man, NES is just such an awesome system.
Dude, that's one hell of a gift to just get like out of the blue. Like, yeah. You're in trouble. I'm so glad you got in trouble, because man, dude, like these memories I've just, you know, gotten from this, like, wow, dude.
Yeah, that's crazy. Amazing. So, did you have a lot of friends growing up who were also into the system? Like, would you go to school and talk about games and things like that?
Dude, totally. Like, there was other kids on campus, you know, at the elementary school, and you know, we'd all be talking about Mario Brothers. Like, hey, dude, can you beat this level? I've only gotten this far, or like, you know, this is a trick that I've learned. Check this out. Considering this is all pre-YouTube, right? Pre-internet. So any tips and tricks that I could get from other people that I knew played, like, then more power to, you know, to them, and also, you know, thanking them for hooking me up with these tidbits.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, but yeah, no, totally. I think the biggest one, though, that most people, you know, at the time had to play was Super Mario. I think it was Mario Brothers 2 and roughly 3. Considering we got the console later, I think they picked one up in like 1990. My family did, like 89 or 90. So the console had already, you know, been out 4 or 5 years. And so technically a little late in the game there. But, you know, just enough time for me to still get in on it and start talking to friends at school about it.
So did you have a lot of games for the system, or did you just have the Mario Brothers games?
So at the time, like, I don't know if my mom and dad were being kind of cheap, but they wouldn't really buy us too many games. We only had like 3 or 4 games, maybe 5. And I feel like that's kind of what has lended, which we might talk about soon, but what has lended to me wanting to collect them, you know, once I became an adult and now I had some money and I can start buying, like, I feel like that's what kind of fueled that. But to go back, we only had a handful of games. However, the kick-ass thing about that, though, is that we had a video game store right down the street. It was literally like labeled Video. That was the name of the store. And it was just like, you know, very like sans serif font. It just said Video in white writing. Anyway, we'd go there, and dude, that's where I discovered some of my all-time favorite games. And yeah, man, like, there was just
Name some of your favorites.
So hands down, I would say one of my favorite, at least NTSC, like, localized for the States, it's going to be River City Ransom.
Nice.
I just feel like that game was way ahead of its time. For when it was released, which was, I believe, 89 in the States. And so anyway, that was one of my favorites. That's where I discovered like Ninja Gaiden. I had discovered Double Dragon, a lot of co-op games. Actually, I had gone through, because at the time I have 2 older brothers. My oldest brother, Robert, was, you know, significantly older than my second oldest brother. So I didn't really hang out with him too much. My second oldest brother, at least to me, he was about 4 or 5 years older. So just close enough to where we could hang still and play games together. Mm-hmm. And so we did, you know, and so we did a lot of co-op games on the NES, as many as we could. But yeah, so that was a good chunk of my early childhood with gaming. It was just, you know, going to that game store, renting a bunch of games. And so fortunately, I did have access to, like, you know, tons of titles, but we didn't own too many, to answer the question.
I love that store didn't try to get creative with their name. They're just like, yep, this is what we do. Video.
Straight up, dude. It just said Video. I mean, like, as soon as you walked in, they even had like, it had a super tiny adult section. You could always, you know, the thing is they had these curtains there. You could always still kind of peek in. so, you know, I try not to look, but as a kid, you get kind of curious. And so occasionally I would peek in. It was a small joint. That store, that location still exists to this day, but now it's like a mobile store or something like that. Like, it's now changed. I actually bought a couple of games from there once they were getting rid of their inventory. I ended up buying a handful of them. So I still have a couple of those games actually from that video store.
And going back to your love of River City Ransom, didn't you use that art style for your A Winner Is You stuff?
Oh my gosh, dude, did I? Like, yeah. I mean, I think a big reason why I like it too is because it's got this like pseudo anime vibe to
it. They're so expressive, their faces.
When they get hit, from when they're hopping and jumping, like punching, like from when they're, you know, when they're eating, ordering food, like they're very, very expressive. And so I think to me, again, like seeing that as a kid too, like seeing all these expressions coming from these characters from this like NES game, where like I really didn't see that in any other title.
Yeah.
Also really had me like, damn, dude, like that is so cool. Like, well, how are they doing this in this game? But I don't see this in other games. Like,
why they did a great job. I mean, plus you have the text at the bottom of the screen. Like that game had so much personality. It's awesome.
Oh my God, it did. And then the cool thing was, is I discovered that line of characters, it's known as Kunio-kun, right? In Japan. Yep. But like, I didn't know that as a kid. And they had localized other Kunio-kun games, but they were just like Crashing the Boys. It was World Cup Soccer. So anyway, when we got lucky and rented like one of those games, we're like, oh shit, it's River City Ransom, but they're playing soccer? What the hell? This is so dope. You know, I had a friend introduce me to dodgeball in middle school. Like I didn't know they played dodgeball, but they did. And so, yeah, so things like that. And that kind of forever became my like, that series, that like, you know, what's the word for it? Not series. There's a name for it. Franchise, I guess. Franchise, Kunio-kun. So that became, you know, my favorite game.
So the games that you mentioned, Super Dodgeball, you know, River City Ransom, are those legitimately considered in the same series?
From what I understand, they are. They're part of the Kunio-kun like universe or that world. There was a ton more that weren't localized in the States, where like they played hockey, they played basketball. There's a bunch. They're all related, and they all, you know, they always use Kunio, and then they always use his buddy Riki, which is known as Alex and Ryan in the States. Crazy story, dude. This blew my mind. But so my buddy, one of my buds from high school, I found out later in life that his mom actually worked for Technos Japan, but in America.
No way.
So she worked for them back in San Jose, California, where they used to have their office. And when they were localizing River City Ransom at the time, my buddy's mom had brought in his brother to work. And the people who were localizing the game and giving names to characters were like, hey, what's the name of your kid, or what's your kid's name? And they're like, oh, his name is Ryan. Okay, Ryan. Okay, that's a good name. Cool, thanks. Yeah. And they ended up naming Ryan, but you know, Riki became Ryan, but they got Ryan from my buddy's brother.
Dude, that's insane.
When he went into his mom's work, like, who knew? Like, what the hell? And get this, he actually owns a prototype of River City Ransom that his mom got from when the game was being localized.
Holy cow.
Yeah, dude. So I'm like, oh my God, like that is so fucking cool, dude. Like, anyway, my buddy's name is Rainier. His brother's name is Ryan. So my buddy Rainier has a prototype that his mom had legitimately got from the company at the time. And that, you know, they held on to.
I feel like you should have led with that story. I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
Dude, well, see, I mean, I forget that, you know, that's a thing that happened. And so I actually had him send me a picture of him like holding it and like smiling all crazy. And like, I was like, dude, you gotta send it to me, dude. Like, I'd love to see that. But yeah, if I dig it up, man, I'll send it to you.
That's awesome. I'd love to see it.
For sure, man.
So as time went on, you know, you got older, went to middle school, went to high school.
Yeah.
Did you continue to play NES throughout that time, or did you kind of move on to other systems and then come back to it as an adult?
Oh, that's a great question, dude. I think to the simple answer is I had moved on. PlayStation 1 became like my next baby. Like I just to this day, I still have, I'm super passionate about PlayStation 1. I had even considered game dev in PlayStation 1, like that environment, like that was, I had so much love for that console as well. I can send you a picture of this, but I wrote a quote unquote, I wrote a book in sixth grade. It was a little short book, but it's titled Resident Evil. I'm looking at the book right now. It's right in front of me. It's April 9th, 1997, Resident Evil. The games that were on that console just like really expanded my passion and my appreciation for gaming in general. Yeah. It really just broadened my perspective on what games were and what they become.
Going to CDs for game data, I mean, it opened it up to where games could be huge on that system.
Oh, dude, massive. And then, like, they're just big environments. They're big worlds, you know? And Definitely. So Resident Evil 1 was my first game on PlayStation 1. That's the first game I ever played on PlayStation 1. And I actually initially played it at a buddy's house one day after school. And let's see. But yeah, I had, you know, games like Jet Moto. I don't know, just a ton of titles to me that were just like amazing. I'm like, I don't know. It was like Street Fighter Alpha. The original was on there too, that I had played. But anyway, so outside of the NES, PlayStation was a big console for me. I ended up, to continue on with the story though, I did end up going back to, before I go back to the NES, another big console for me that was just also kind of like maybe monumental, you know, pretty important to me was the Dreamcast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, dude. I ended up buying that with my lunch money that I saved up in high school. I think I was a freshman or sophomore in high school. And, you know, my parents would give me like a few bucks every day to get something to eat for lunch at school. And, you know, usually you could buy like a hot dog or something and like some soda, but I wasn't buying anything. I was just literally pocketing the money and saving it for months.
Were you eating anything?
No, I was not.
You're so tiny.
Yeah, dude. I kept myself thin throughout that entire time, dude, for sure. I ate a little bit at home right before leaving, and then I just wouldn't eat at school. And then when I got home, I'd like, you know, wolf stuff down.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, man, no, totally. I saved up my money. I bought myself a Dreamcast. And at the time, you know, so I'll go back even a little further back to when I had the PlayStation 1. A buddy of mine, him and I figured out how to modify PlayStations back in seventh grade. And he had used his dad's,
hang on. How do you just figure that out? Like, what are you talking about?
Okay. Let me clear the air here. Let me clear this up. So what happened is I had a buddy. I'll use names. His name was Mike. So my buddy, Mike, his dad was very computer savvy at the time. We're looking at 1996, 1997, like 97. His dad was super computer savvy. He was at the forefront when the internet exploded. Like, he had the computer. He had, you know, that 56K dial up. Like, mm-hmm. He was connected. Like, and, you know, so my buddy Mike introduced me to the internet. Like, then that's when I discovered it too. I'm like, holy shit. Like, there's so much information online. And literally, a year and a half after the internet was birthed, like, we're already finding information on how to modify PlayStations, you know, through forums were being created. And so my buddy Mike found a diagram online on how to modify a PlayStation 1. You need a capacitor an integrated circuit, and you need some wires. And okay, cool. And then so we ended up buying the parts with his dad's credit card. And we got to work, dude. My PlayStation, which I still own to this day, was the guinea pig, and it was successful. Like, we successfully modded the PlayStation 1.
So then, you're taking it apart, you're soldering stuff, yep. You're doing all of that.
Yep, all of it,
seventh
dude.
In seventh grade,
dude. And we ended up starting momentarily a small business where we were modding friends' PlayStations.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, hell dude, yeah. And the guarantee is if we mess your shit up, we'll give you our PlayStation. That was the guarantee, you know? Wow. And so
did you mess any up?
Nope. Nope, would not one, man. So every single PlayStation was nicely modded. And so because of that, though, it did expand, also the inventory of games, right? We were able to download games, the ISOs, and burn them. And so that's when I was first introduced into the Japanese language. I had never heard it until then.
How long did it take to download a game ISO on 56K?
Oh, Lord, dude. Hours, man. It would take forever, dude.
Set it to overnight and go to sleep.
Yeah, dude. And so it got to a point where my buddy Mike couldn't do it because his dad was getting suspicious. He's like, why are you leaving the computer on? Like, you got to shut that off. And so Mike's like, we can't do it at my house, bro. Like, but what we can do is we can borrow some friends' games and we can burn the discs. I have a burner. So I'm like, oh my God. So anyway, so we'd have these games. We never sold the games or anything like that. We would just get the games for ourselves so that we could play them. And so anyway, the Dreamcast was the same deal. Once I got my Dreamcast, my buddy Mike had his. We figured out how to get a boot disc. And so we would download, I think they were GD. It's not CDs. They had like a different name for the disc, but we were able to burn them onto regular discs. And yeah, we were playing, imported games on the Dreamcast as well. And that's when I first played like Jet Set Radio and like a bunch of other really cool titles long before they were released in the States or localized in the States. And so anyway, so those two consoles were super huge in between me stepping away from the NES. And then I would say after all of that happened, I think towards the end of high school, I got busy with like jamming in bands and really pushing the music thing. I was, writing songs. I was going on tours with these bands and so I didn't game for a while, at least up until, I was still gaming occasionally here and there, like when I could squeeze it in, but it wasn't at the forefront anymore. Like it wasn't something that I was looking for. I wasn't seeking new titles or anything like that. But I want to say around the age of like 19 or 20, I came into a little bit of money, and it was actually some money that I had gotten from some grants from school. Like they sent me like a couple grand actually to buy books and things of that sort because I had applied for financial aid. And so they hooked me up with some money. And so I bought the books and I bought what I needed, but I had some leftover money. So then I started to buy some NES games.
So was there a catalyst that made you think like, oh, I want to go seek out NES games? Like you had money. Did you just go to a game store and see them? Like what was it that made you seek them out?
Ah, that's a great question too, man. I think ultimately I started to, I think it might've been, God, I'm trying to remember what triggered it. But I just remember like rediscovering the NES and like, looking back at the games that I was playing as a kid and being like, God, man, how dope would it be to have Mega Man, all six of them, and to have Ninja Gaidens, all three of them, to have all these games and they're so cheap. Like, oh, dude, I gotta get them. And then that just kind of snowballed into being like, well, I have a little bit of money. I have a few hundred bucks left over. I know of a game store, that's selling them for really cheap.
Yeah, they were dirt cheap at that time.
Oh my God, were they? We're talking now, this is like 2005. So this is like during a cusp where people didn't care. That's right
when I got back into it too.
Yeah, dude, people didn't care too much about certain titles because they were significantly cheap. There was still some value on some of the more like popular ones, but nowhere the kinds of prices that you see today.
But Flintstones 2 was like $75 maybe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could still land a stadium events for probably a couple hundred bucks.
Yeah.
At that, so yeah, in different times, man.
Different times for sure.
I think it just triggered. I think I bought like a handful at a video game store. And then I'm just like, well, dude, why don't I just buy more? And so, through the jobs I got to, working at Starbucks, working at Blockbuster, working at, places like that, I was able to buy more games here and there. And I just kind of made a commitment to myself that I was going to collect them. And it was around then that I decided, yeah, I will be a NES collector, not necessarily PS1, not necessarily Dreamcast. Like, I love those consoles too, but I just wanted to bring it back to my roots. And that's kind of that's what the sentiment was behind beginning to collect for the console.
So yeah. Let's take a step back. Okay. You mentioned you were getting really into music, jamming with bands. Mm-hmm. Obviously these days, and we didn't even touch on this, you are clearly an accomplished musician. You give private lessons from beginner to expert and all genres. Mm-hmm. Did you get into music in school? Like, when did you start learning that you were good at music and started pushing that?
Damn, dude. Great question. So now I'm going to make reference to my buddy Mike again. He knows this. I've told him many times, like, this dude he's super important in my life because of the things that he introduced me to. He introduced me to punk rock. So
what year is this?
This is now 97 to 98. Okay. 97, 98. He introduced me to bands like The Offspring, Bad Religion, Pennywise, you know, different bands either from like Fat Records or Epitaph at the time, or any, you know, like just a bunch of different record labels. But these bands were super important because they also inspired him to want to play guitar. And so I was like, well, hey, Mike, why don't we start a band, dude? Like, I'll play drums and you play guitar. And so he started taking guitar lessons like within like that month that we decided we're going to start jamming
and
together.
You're teenagers at this point,
we're teenagers. Yeah. We're seventh graders, man. We're like 12 turning 13. Like, and we're already making this commitment that we want to be punk rockers, because we were also skating together. We were also in that environment, and that just kind of went hand in hand, punk bands and skating.
Yeah. No, I was there too. So you get it. Oh yeah.
That's so dope. And so then, I started to, so as Mike Drake was learning guitar, he was also kind of showing me some riffs that he was learning from his guitar lessons. And then as far as drums go, I had asked my parents if they could buy me a drum set. And so they weren't able to buy it outright, so they had to put one on layaway. But fortunately, I ended up getting one within like less than a year from the time that I had asked them for a drum set. I spent so much time on that drum set. I still have my very first recording with this other kid that I also jammed with initially. So that's what triggered, like, okay, I'm going to be a musician. Like, I want to be on stage. I want to perform. Like, I love playing these punk rock songs. How cool would it be if I could play my own punk rock songs in front of other people, you know, like The Offspring does, or like Pennywise does? Like, that is so cool. Yeah, that's where that started. That's how that began.
So this is before First Act was making instruments. Like, what brand was your first drum set?
That's a great question. It was CB Percussion. Okay. It was like an off brand that was sold by a super small shop, a little tiny music store in San Jose. And it was just called CB Percussion. The tuning on it was awful. And so I found ways to like mute or not mute, but to like pacify the overly resonating heads, the weird boom sounds that it would make from like, you know, bad tuning and like just not good, tuning pegs, or insufficient tuning pegs in this case, 'cause it only had six on the bass drum.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, Jesus Christ, like that's six. Like, what are you going to do with six? And anyway, I didn't know any better, but I found ways to tune it to where it sounded kick ass. Like, my friends loved playing on my drum set, even though it was a piece of crap because of the way I tuned it. So that was my first drum set. It was a CB drums or CB percussion. And the first guitar I ever played on was Mike Drake's guitar, which was, I believe, a Kramer. I think that was a brand. It was a black one. It was a black Kramer, I believe. But those are the first two instruments that I actually like played on.
So did you take lessons over time, or are you just progressing at your own pace and became a prodigy?
I appreciate that. Let's see now. So the way it happened was I was listening to the punk rock bands that, you know, Mike had introduced me to, like, you know, especially Offspring, one of my favorite bands. And I'd listen to them, or even Metallica too. Like, I was listening to some Metallica at the time, but I would be listening to the drummers and trying to imitate, like, where the kick went, where the snare went. Having learned, like, a very, very basic rock beat from, like, a friend in school who already played a little bit of drums. He's like, oh yeah, mm-hmm. this is how you do a rock beat. And so taking that fundamental knowledge of, like, okay, so if this is where the kick goes and this is where the snare goes, if I can just imitate the way this drummer is doing it in this song, which is just a little faster, but it's kind of close enough. And so I just started working on the coordination of where my right hand hi-hat would land in respect to either a kick or snare, and trying to find that in between or on top of kind of hit.
Yeah.
So a lot of it was self-taught. As far as hand rudiments go, my next door neighbor was a Vanguard marching drummer.
So drum corps?
Yeah, drum corps. He was a freaking beast. Dude was dope. His younger brother was actually our bass player. Anyway, his older brother, his name was Mario. This dude was a dope drummer. And so what he would do is occasionally be like, hey, Serge, let me show you some cool hand rudiments.
These paradiddle.
Yeah, dude, I was just going to say, paradiddles is one of the ones he taught me, right? And so I was just like, dude, okay, paradiddles are so sick. Like, that is so cool. And he started showing me what flams were and, like, uh-huh. just all these, like, different hand rudiments that I had no idea, but were so fundamental in shaping, like, my coordination and my ability to have, like, I don't know, like, really fast single strokes and yeah. things of that sort. But they weren't lessons. It was just impromptu, like, hey, Serge, let me show you something real quick, you know? And so a lot of what I did learn, they were from listening to CDs and even cassettes at the time to really.
It's amazing how really seemingly random events, people that you live near, like, all of these factors, they take such a direct impact on shaping who we are today. It's crazy to think about stuff like that.
Dude, hands down. I don't know. I feel like it really has. I mean, it's those kinds of interactions that have shaped me, that mm-hmm. they've turned me into the person that I've become. They've turned me into the musician that I've become. I don't know. Yeah, hands down, dude, I agree with you. I think it's mind blowing. And I'm also super thankful for those kinds of, like, little moments that existed. And so once I got decent at the drums by eighth grade, I ended up joining band in school. So I was part of the jazz band. And I was just, you know, playing
as a drummer, or were you playing
as a drummer? Yeah, I was able to join as a drummer, and they had me playing full kit, which was really cool. There's a couple of pieces that I played, like, just snare, like, I'm reading music.
Yeah.
Very basic, like, rhythmic music, nothing complex.
Yeah, eighth grade, they usually don't throw too much at you.
Yeah, no, dude, I had to keep it simple, man. I had a hard time reading music. So I was able to jam with them. But come high school, like, I didn't do marching band or anything like that. But I was jamming with a lot of, like, high school bands, you know, punk rock bands. Mike was a part of some of it. And then I had, you know, other buddies I ended up jamming with throughout that course.
All right. Yeah. So 2004, 2005, you start getting back into NES. You start collecting games.
Yeah.
How do you get introduced to NES homebrew?
Oh, man. Okay, so I had no idea that games were being developed for the NES that were essentially new. You know, there were these people who were coding, you know, these games for the NES, you know, and it blew my mind that there was a way that you can get that code onto the chip and then get it in a cartridge and a shell and then put it together and put your own label on it. Like, that I had no idea that it existed. So
punk rock video games, man.
Yeah, dude, that's what it was. Totally was, man. Like, at the core, totally. And So I ended up stumbling across Bunny Boy's site, Retro USB. I had stumbled across his site just looking up, like, I don't know what I was looking up. I was looking up like NES games. And I forget what the Google search was, but I came across his site. And I saw that he had like cool components for NES stuff. I'm like, oh, cool. He has some cool peripherals that you can, you know, connect your computer to using USB stuff. And then I looked at a handful of games that he had on there. And I'm like, what are these? You know? And then that's when I saw that these games are being developed by people. I wanted to buy one of them. And the one that caught my attention, the art on it was like pixelated. It kind of felt like black box art, even though it wasn't black box art. But it just, something about that pixelation, just like, it really piqued my interest. At that time, I was already into black box games and collecting those. So I'm just like, okay, I want this. Like, it's just, it was emotional. It was an emotional reaction when I saw that art. And that game was Sneaking Peek. It was actually your game. It's actually your game. And so the caveat to me being able to buy it was I had to sign up on this forum called Nintendo Age. And I did just that. I got onto Nintendo Age because I wanted to buy your game because I needed to sign up. I needed to be a part of a list. And yeah, man.
How disappointed were you when you got it?
Dude, not at all, actually. Not at all. Like, to me, at that point, once I popped it in and I was playing it, I'm thinking, somebody coded this. This wasn't like a company. Like, someone like single-handedly did this. Like, that is so freaking cool. And I just, the only problem I had was trying to find people to play it with me. Yeah. Cause I was playing the NES alone half the time. So, to me, it was dope. I know some people are like, Sneaking Peek is, yeah, it's an okay game. No, I thought it was dope, bro. I thought it was dope.
Oh man. I remember the first time you told me that story in Portland. It still blows my mind.
Yeah, dude, totally, man. No, it's,
When did you, like, how long after that did you decide, I want to get involved in some way in being a part of creating something like this?
I think initially what ended up happening was, I saw what you were doing. I saw what Roth was doing. I saw what, Brian Bunny Boy was doing. Like, I saw what people were doing and I'm like, God, that's so damn cool. Like, I would love to do that, but I don't have like the know-how. Like, I don't know any coding. I don't know how to do any of that stuff. And so I started thinking, well, what I could probably do is I could probably collaborate with someone. I could provide the music. At that point I was already making those YouTube videos where like I do like a massive arrangement where I play a handful of instruments. But I would take the music and the four or five channels that existed for, you know, an NES composition, I would separate them, and try to be like as pure as possible to, or as true as possible to the original composition, but to then translate that and give it an interpretation, my interpretation of what I felt like it would be, or basically in an arrangement. I'm sorry, I'm like not able to find the correct words here. But anyway, I had already done that. And so I had already started building a small following for myself in that area that like, yes, I am passionate about this. Like, I'm not just... So
to clarify, you're taking the NES arrangements and playing them on modern instruments?
Correct. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. I didn't clarify that. Yes. It's like, you know, taking the first like square channel, the lead channel and putting that on guitar one, second square, you know, maybe guitar two, yep. You know, or maybe a different instrument, you know, I might put that on something else. But anyway, so it was doing stuff like that. So we had that going. So I figured, if I can't code, maybe I could work with someone that could, help help, you know, propel this vision, this dream. What ended up happening was, I don't know if you remember Gwendian, James.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
So I was hanging out with him one day. I was chilling at his house and he goes, "Hey, Serge, I got this really cool prototype of, I forget what game he said. It was like a relatively big title. So I got this really cool prototype. Check this out, man." I'm like, "Wait, what? No way, dude." Like, "Oh," he said, "Stadium Events prototype." And I'm like, "That's dude, no way, James, like no way." And so he pops it in and we get Rick Astley popping up. "Never going to give you up." Never going to, you know, I'm just like, "Oh dude, that's up, bro, like come on, man."
NES Rick rolling.
Yeah, but it was a short loop. It was like a 10 or 15 second loop of utilizing the DPCM channel of like compressed audio. And I'm like,
"Yeah,
wait, hold up, dude, wait. If you could do this, that means wait, how could we expand on that? Like, oh my God." And then, mm-hmm. So it like blew my mind. And I'm like thinking, what if we put this on like an actual album on a cartridge? And so then I started asking questions on Nintendo Age. And again, granted, mind you, I at this point, I think I had been on the front cover of Nintendo Age. So like, again, I wasn't just like, I guess, a random person asking questions. But it was more so like, I don't even know if the cred even mattered at the time, but like I was just being polite and asking questions, right? And I ended up asking James to like how I would do something like that. He put me in contact with someone. I forget who it was. They were saying we could put a CD inside of a cartridge, and then you could just market it that way. And so I'm thinking, that's not really what I'm thinking. Like, how could we put audio like on the actual board? Person's like, "Yeah, that can't be done." So I'm like, you know what? It can be done. I just saw it, dude. Like I got Rick rolled, man. Like, of course it could be done. And so I'm thinking, okay, I got to keep asking questions. I ended up asking one of like Nintendo Age's like amazing programmer, like just super, like I've played a lot of his games at that point. Like I knew who he was and I knew the kind of work he had done. And so in my mind, not that I knew right off the top that he would be able to do it. I had faith. I'm like, dude, if anyone can do it, if anybody could do something wild like this, it's gotta be Shiru. Like there's no other way. And yep. So, yeah, I reached out to Shiru, you know, and asking the questions like, "Hey, dude, is something like this possible?" And his response was just like, "Yeah, it's possible." I'm like, wait, hold up. What? He's like, "Yeah, and we could probably go, you know, this is how much room it's going to take up, considering the kind of compression we would use and you know, the data format that it's going to be in. Like, this is what we're looking at. So what we need is someone who's got some clever kick-ass like hardware skills." So, and he's like,
"Yeah, wonder who that might be."
Right. And so even Shira was like, "You know, I know that, you know, Bunny Boy is pretty kick-ass at that kind of thing. You should ask him." So I was like, okay. So then I go to Brian, I go to Retro USB, I shoot him a message. I'm like, "Hey dude, this is the idea I've got. You know, I spoke with another programmer, says the idea is feasible. And, you know, I mean, this is what I do. Check out some of my videos. Like, would you be interested in a collaboration?" Cause at that point, you know, he didn't know me either. Bunny Boy didn't know me. I don't know if are we using like screen names, or are we just going to use names? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's whatever comes to mind.
Okay. So, I'll just say Bunny Boy for now. So, he didn't know me. I didn't know him, but through that interaction, I think I got at the time, I don't know who it was that was handling his emails, but
probably Paul.
Probably Paul at the time. Okay. Paul was like, "Dude, I'm a fan of your work. I think that's a kick-ass idea. I will absolutely put this in front of him." So I was like, okay, that's where, like, I was so thankful that I had made those videos now that, like, that was happening. That was a thing. And so, yeah, sure enough, you know, he gets back to me, Buddy Boy gets back to me and he's like, yeah, I could do that. We can go. These are the sizes that we could probably do. I can probably go about, you know, we could maybe hit 128, but I could solidly do 64. And this is, you know, we started getting into the cost of things and what it all looks like.
And we're talking about megabytes, right?
We're talking, sorry. Yes. Not 64K. We're talking about 64 megabytes. Correct. Correct. Yeah. Not KB. It's, we're looking at the MB. And so, yeah, I ran that. And so I was basically, it, like, kind of in the middle. I'm like running this information back and forth between Shiru and Bunny Boy. Like, hey, okay, I've got this now. We're capable of doing this. You know, what can we do now? Like, what should we do next? What's the next idea? And so I wasn't even done with the album yet. Like, I wasn't done with, like, my side of the arrangements. Like, it was, everything was happening so quickly that I had to turn a lot of what was already on there. Like, what ended up going on that cartridge, I had to just record them. No filming, no like, going up on YouTube, because I didn't have time to do that. I had to just get a great recording and you know, mix it, master it, get it ready to go for compression. And so we ended up taking a bunch of wave files, so the highest possible quality that I could output, because they were going to be heavily compressed. And so, yeah. So, I mean, we might have been able to use MP3s. It's just how it would have been compressed and it might not have sounded best. So using wave files was going to be higher quality. And so, but anyway, so that ended up happening. And now that this is, I was going to say long story short, it's already kind of a long story. it all just came together. You know, the artwork was River City Ransom inspired because that was my favorite game as a kid. Yeah, so all of it just kind of came together. And so we ended up launching a Kickstarter for it. But I think there were too many extras on the Kickstarter, which kind of convoluted what the overall idea and or goal for the Kickstarter was. Yeah. And so it wasn't successful. And so what we ended up doing was releasing the game as a limited edition. They were these clear shells on Nintendo Age, which kickstarted the revenue needed to help pay off production costs and programming and all that stuff. And so then what ended up happening afterwards is Bunny Boy just ended up picking it up and putting it on Retro USB as just an ongoing game that gets sold. And so, yeah, man. So that's what happened with the Winner's You. That's the story.
I mean, proof's in the pudding, man. That all the audio on that sounds amazing. So you guys went the right route doing the wave files.
Yeah, man. Yeah, totally, dude. I think it was because again, they were going to be heavily compressed, and so we had to get the highest possible quality. Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. So that's kind of what triggered, you know, wanting to stay in NES development as well. Like that's yeah.
Now you've done more than that since then, because you've done some chiptune music in a couple projects, right?
Yep. Oh yeah.
How did you transition to that? Did you already know how to use Famitracker? Did you teach yourself when the opportunity arose? Like, how did you get going with that?
That's another great question. So, the first I want to say, so I had dabbled with Famitracker before actually putting a lot of my music on an actual game, which at the time was Ninja. So I dabbled a little bit with Famitracker, just self-taught, just kind of figuring that out. Just no real training. Like I wasn't quite understanding like these like values that were being input, like these little hex values. I'm like, what the hell is hex? Like, I have no idea. So then I just kind of put it away. I'm like, you know, Famitracker is too complicated. I don't like it. And then I ended up working, with the individual who programmed Ninja. And that was an entirely, entirely different process for writing music. Like, way, 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 way different, way more complicated than Famitracker was, you know? And so, but because of that though, I started to learn what hex values were. I started to learn like how to essentially do some programming actually through that. And so that's actually where my like current passion for programming began. It was because of Ninja, and having to write music for that game just straight up in hex values.
I didn't know that was a direct sort of catalyst for you getting into programming.
Yeah, no, absolutely, man. Cause that was my first like hands-on experience. Like I'm on a project and I got to deliver. So I'm going to work hard on this. And we spent an entire summer. I think it was like 2015 or 2016. Forget what year it was. It was one of those years. It was shortly after the release of Winner Is You that, I ended up writing music for that game. And so that was my direct experience with composing there. And so then shortly afterwards, I started dabbling more now with Family Tracker because I'm like, well, if I was able to write for this game, which was way more complicated, I should try Family Tracker again. And so then I did. And I just started to write some, you know, some tunes just for myself, you know, nothing too crazy or too big. And so then I think what ended up happening. Oh, I did end up giving some music to some other people that it wasn't Family Tracker, though. It was, I think, for PC Engine. So I was able to just like write music as is. And so I was able to, you know, put that out, which I thought was cool. But going back to the NES, I think might have been for the upcoming game. Are we able to talk about that, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
We are? Sure. Okay. let's see now. Was it? No, I feel like there was another project in between. I don't remember.
I feel like there was too, but I can't put my finger on what it is.
Right, exactly. And I'm trying to remember which one it was too. I cannot remember for the life of me, but I know there was. But anyway, shortly after that, I do believe John reached out to me, or maybe I reached out to him, and I'm like, hey, now there's another project that I cannot talk about. It is in the works, and it's been in the works way back then. Like it's been in the works since way back then.
Oh wow!
It was before the video project, the full motion NES video project. And so anyway,
wow! So that far back.
It was that far back, dude. Yeah. So this has been in the works for some time. But I reached out to John, and I'm like, hey, dude, could you hook me up with some art? And in exchange, you know, I'll write you some music whenever you need it. And he's like, dude, that is a kick-ass deal. And at this point, I
and we're talking about Peekaboos, right?
Yes, we're talking about Peekaboos. Okay, Shout out.
Oh, John.
Yeah, dude. So, and the thing is, I had seen his art in your game. It was Netscape. Mm-hmm. And I think that was his first time?
Yep, that was his first game.
That was okay. And I saw and I loved it. And I'm like, that's really cool. I, you know, I liked the way it looked. And so I reached out to him. And again, so I was like, yeah, I'll hook you up with music. You hook me up with art. How does that sound? He says, let's do it. So then, I mean, I've already got some really cool backgrounds for this game that I cannot talk about. The time came and, you know, John was going to be working on his game or your guys' game. He's like,
which is Courier.
Yeah. I keep forgetting we could talk about these things. I feel so like, you know, I can't say anything.
You're on the inside, man.
For sure. What was it? So he goes, okay, it's time. I'm going to use that coupon with Surge. And so I was like, yeah, dude, hands down, I'll write you whatever you need, dude. Like, I gotcha. And so I ended up tracking Courier. And a lot of it was just kind of based off of what John felt like was needed. Hey, we need like some battle theme. We want an intro theme, maybe like an exploratory theme.
And he gave you some inspiration ideas, right? Of like things that the game was influenced by.
Yes, correct. Yes. Okay. Yeah. I think there might have even been a screenshot of like of what the art was looking like. So I had a better understanding of like the kind of emotions I needed to invoke with the compositions. I'm trying to think what the next step was. I ended up doing the initial tracking, and then it was some time later actually that I think the project picked back up. And at some point, I remember I think you were asking like, "Hey, dude, like, is there any way we can get something that's just kind of like atmospheric or ambient or ambient, right? So I'm like, okay, I got you.
How do you do that on NES?
I got you, bro. I got you. And so I ended up tracking, that ambient, that like rise and fall of like, you know, this kind of background.
Oh, so good.
And so the thought behind that and the reason why it sounds the way it does is because I thought about the harmonies that I was choosing. I tried to stay away from chords that had significant quality to them. So I was trying to stay away from like major thirds and minor thirds, even sixths, you know what I'm saying? And so I just kind of stuck around fourths and fifths. That's it. So they stayed quality free. And then the chord progression itself, I did my best to stay away from what we felt would have been like the proper next chord to go to.
Right.
And instead go to the next potential chord that would substitute nicely next to that instead. And so that was the thought behind creating like what my thought process was like for that particular track, is to create like an environment, like an audio environment where you kind of have an idea where it's going to go next, but you don't, to help aid in the like ambient ambiguity of the room that you're in. You know, so it's just really to kind of add to that. So anyway, that was the thought process behind that. Yeah.
So you and I are in a unique position of being two of the only people that have played through Courier now. How do you feel the music works in the game? Are you happy with how it all turned out?
I love it, to be honest. I think there was there was one or two changes where I was like, oh yeah, this could probably work for like battle music. But then what you guys decided to do with it and introduce it, you know, much later in the game, I thought made it more powerful. Like it really made it stood out way better than my initial view or what I interpreted as, you know, it being or needed to be kind of thing. Like, I'm glad you guys did what you did with some of the arrangement of what should go where.
I can't wait for people to play it, man. Yeah. I'm so damn proud of that project. And the fact that I got to work with you, man, it's a dream. I'm glad that we finally got to work together.
Oh, dude, no, the pleasure is all mine, man. Honestly, dude, like I've seen so many, I've played and I've picked up so many of your releases, dude. Like, this to me is an honor in itself to be able to provide music for something that you and John put together. Like, that's so dope, dude. You know, so kick ass, man. And so,
well, not to mention that it's almost like a full circle thing for you, because Sneak and Peek, you know, a game that I did, brought you into the scene. And then here you are, what, 10 years later, working on one of my games.
Working directly with the guy who got me in.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, for sure, bro. Like that, I think that to me was, again, it's a pretty profound thing to have happened. But yeah, no, I'm super happy about it. I mean, I think, I'm trying to think, there was a, I think initially, wait, was it recently? Yeah. I sent you an update, on one of the tracks. Cause I'm like, I felt like it just needed to expand just a little bit just because of the repetition of it. And so I was like, okay, let's chat just a little tiny bit, just a little bit, you know, just to change it up a hair.
Hey, game's not out yet, so may as well.
For sure. But yeah, man, so absolutely. It's been, again, one hell of a ride, dude, from the start of things to where we are today, you know. And now we have so another project I have coming out is You Are Error, which is essentially like another first of its kind. Where we have, I mean, there's been, I've seen like, I think Shiro had actually shown me someone who had done like video compression, like using an NES emulator, and like, you know, you see some footage, but as far as getting it on hardware connected with audio and not just 8-bit, but actual like, you know, recordings, as far as I know, you know, we have been the first to put that out. And so, but anyway, that project, I think what was cool about it and super inspiring was to be able to see like what looks to be like the Game Boy camera kind of graphics, but mm-hmm. like you're seeing it, you know, coming from your NES with real audio. And then you have these cool capabilities of like fast forwarding, rewinding, slow motion. Like, I don't know. I just think the whole project, what it became, I think was pretty awesome. And I think it's kind of funny just to add a little bit to that story was, I think, I remember when I had mentioned that idea to Brian, to Bunny Boy, at first we were like, you know, it sounds so dope. It sounds so cool, but it's going to be kind of hard to sell an NES video cart, you know? And, mm-hmm. and then fast forward, you know, to, was it earlier this year, like the Kickstarter raised like 15K in, you know what I'm saying? So it didn't have any yep. trouble selling. Yeah, anyway, that was, that's some of the story of how things went down with that one.
So where is that project at right now?
So right now, actually just this past weekend maybe three, at PRGE, I ended up picking up the printed materials. We've got boxes now, we've got labels, we've got manuals. So
did you go through Frank for those?
No, not Frank. I went through Vince. I went through nice. Vince, Uncle Tusk, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what he goes by. So Uncle Tusk. Yeah. And so the quality is top notch, man. It's fantastic. And so right now we still don't have boards. We're still waiting for the boards to come in from overseas. And so that's been the major holdup, you know, because the idea would have been that once the Kickstarter was finished, what was going to just take time was assembling the carts and, like, you know, getting stuff packaged and the labels applied and, you know.
Dude, it's such a process.
Oh my God, is it, dude? Is it? Oh my God, man. Like, my experience with that, with Ninja, when that got released on Kickstarter, like, man, like, once you go past like 100 units, like, your hands hurt, dude. Like, they genuinely hurt from, you know, all the labeling and then the screwing on of stuff. But anyway.
Yeah, when we did Any Escape, John flew down, and then my buddy Kendall, who helped write the puzzles for the game, mm-hmm. we blocked out, I think, an entire weekend, like 3 days, and we did, I want to say, like 410 copies or something, and like it just you almost have to just turn off your brain and just turn into a machine and just screw.
God, yeah, there's so many, dude. That's the part that actually hurts my hand is actually screwing the bolts into the shells, you know?
Well, yeah, you got to use a tiny screwdriver to fit in the stupid holes. Yeah, so dude. Your head doesn't fit in your hand. It's the worst.
Yeah, man, that's wild though. But yeah, dude, that's it's quite the process, but that's where we are, you know, we're right there. And so it's just waiting for that stuff to come in. The album for the release is done. Everything's finished. It's just now, I got to get that sent over actually to the people who are making the cassettes. There is some stuff I was waiting on for the art on the actual cassettes themselves. And so that's why that's been held up a little bit. But other than that, like, yeah, I mean, everything is still moving. I think once the boards come in, everything can just move forward.
And for anyone who missed the Kickstarter when it was going, is there going to be a way for people to pick that up after the fact?
Yes, you can actually go to urerror.com right now and pre-order the game or the music cart. Video card, nice. Sorry. You can pre-order it now. And again, that's UR error. So you're going to have two E's in there. It's going to be kind of weird, but it's urerror.com. And yeah, you can read about it there as well. I think Shiru had a write-up that I have linked to on the site. So you can read about the process and some of his tips and tricks of how he went about, you know, how he went about it. And again, what his thought process was. Which I think to me is always like super cool. So like to get into the mind, you know, of Shiro to like understand like how he overcomes like the issues that arise and the solutions he comes up with. You know, I think to me is as a programmer today, now as a developer, I'm super inspired by the work he does.
Dude's a genius.
Dude, hands down.
Yeah.
Hands down, dude.
It's super impressive seeing what he does.
Yeah, dude, to say the least, for sure. And so, yeah, so that's where that project is right now. And again, there's another one still in the works, which I can't say too much about, but do be ready for that one as well.
Well, man, I feel like I could sit here and talk to you another hour. All your stories are so good, but definitely want to keep it short for people.
For sure, man.
So to finish up, are there any other than the project you can't talk about? Like what are your plans for the future of you in regards to NES?
Well, there's going to be that upcoming project for sure. That's going to be another fun one for everybody to enjoy. But as of right now, I'm still in the process of trying to pick up some assembly or you know, for being able to code in assembly. Because I do eventually want to, develop my own game. Oh, I didn't mention this, but for this year's Christmas cart, I think I'm allowed to say this. But anyway,
he talked about it. I think a little bit was discussed during the Spectrum marathon that I did. I think it's safe.
Okay. I don't want to everything is always like, I got to not say anything. I got to wait. So anyway, I did the music actually for, this year's Christmas cart. And so that's something to look out for as well. When that comes out, it'll have been something that I wrote in. There were some huge limitations with how that worked. Now I'll gladly talk about it, some other time.
Yeah, I'll have to bring you back on, man. Have a part two.
For sure, dude. And there was a huge lot of learning with that particular ROM that we, yeah. Anyway, so we'll talk about it later. And so keep an eye out for that one. That'll be fun. And UR Error, again, please check that out. You can pre-order that now, urerror.com. I am going to be releasing my album alongside once the boards come in and I'm able to fulfill the Kickstarter campaign. Then the album that I actually wrote that goes with that video cart will be released as well. And I am going to be marketing that on all platforms like Spotify, hopefully Apple Music, but definitely Spotify, Bandcamp. You'll find it everywhere. It's going to be under the same title of You Are Error. And I'm just using my first and last name on that one, Sergio Elizondo. You could still find it like using Sergio on the holograms if that's easier to spell. Or if you want to look up my stuff, just do Sergio holograms and that'll work as well. But yeah, that's pretty much it. Album, Christmas cart, and, I guess the video cart and album go together. And Courier. Yeah. Keep an eye out, an ear out as well for Courier. Cause that's music that I wrote. Having this amazing opportunity to work with Kevin and John, such an honor, such a blast. So people, be on the lookout for that as well.
And you got to work with John again, cause he did the graphics for the Christmas cart.
Oh really?
Yeah.
What? Oh my gosh. Look at that, dude. We're like working on the same projects. That's so kick ass, dude.
Speaking of the holograms, are there plans to bring them back out and do some more live shows?
Yes, actually. Oh my gosh. Thanks for reminding me, dude. I got to send Christian some stuff, but I'm going to be out at, what was a convention called this one? I'm trying to remember what it's called. Let's Play.
Was it Let's Play? Texas?
In Texas. Yeah.
So
the holograms are actually going to be reappearing next year, sometime in January. I'm trying to remember the dates. I think it's like in the 20s somewhere. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'll be performing in Texas at the Let's Play Gaming Convention. And that'll be out in Texas. So if anyone's in Texas listening to this right now, come check it out. I'll be there. That'll be my first time back since pre-pandemic.
Yeah. For anyone listening, if you get the opportunity, as someone who has seen him perform, I recommend going to check it out. Sergio is awesome.
Thank you, dude. Appreciate that, man. Yeah. It's, the hologram production real quick. It's just, life-size holograms. And that's pretty much what it is. And I play along with a bunch of life-sized holograms. So check it out.
It's so cool.
Appreciate it, man.
All right, man. Anything else you want to talk about?
I mean, that's, Again, I could keep going too, man, but for the sake of the listeners, man, you know, I think I'm good unless there's anything else.
All right, man. We'll bring you back on in the future and we'll get into some nitty gritty.
Dope, man. Sounds good. Well, thanks
so much, man. Thanks so much for your time.
Hey, absolutely, man. Again, I appreciate it. It's been an honor. And yeah, we'll catch up soon.
All right. Take it easy.
All right, man. See ya.
Oh, man. That conversation was so much fun. You know, it seems like he and I, we had a lot of similar experiences growing up with skateboarding and, you know, the type of music we were into, and we could have talked for hours. So I know a lot of that took us a while to get into the homebrew stuff, so we appreciate you sticking with us. But yeah, hopefully we'll be able to bring him back on and talk about some more detail of, you know, maybe how he had the idea for the holograms, how he put them together, and oh man, there's so much to talk about with this stuff. So as always, appreciate you guys hanging out. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I can be found at A Ton of Glaciers. If you want to follow Sergio on Twitter, he can be found at Sergio Elizondo. And I am embarrassed to admit that I have yet to thank the Human Thomas for our new intro song for the Dev Bytes version of the assembly line. So Thomas, thank you, and I'm sorry that it's taken 3 episodes for me to even mention you, but I do always truly appreciate everything that you do for me. So until next time, take it easy and keep playing some homebrew. We'll see you next time.